this day in 2012, Greg Hamm, whose catchy flute solo was featured on Men at Work's Down Under, you can hear here, was found dead at his home in Melbourne, Australia. He was 58. Hamm joined the band in 1979 as a multi-instrumentalist, playing the likes of saxophone and flute, enabling them to great effect in songs like Who Can It Be Now. Now, the flute riff in Down Under was found by a court to have reproduced a substantial part of the folk song Kookaburra Sits in the Old Gum Tree. It was an upbeat, sunny riff, but the legacy of the flute solo in Down Under had long soured for Greg Hamm. He said, "I'm terribly disappointed that that's the way I'm going to be remembered, for copying something," he said. Now, there have been allegations that Hamm had a long battle with heroin addiction, and the cause of death is still being debated, although police said it was non-suspicious. Nonetheless, a brilliant track, wouldn't you agree, Jeremy Elwood?
Yeah,
it's quite something about the song, eh?
I've actually played this song with Colin Hay, the lead singer of Man at Work.
You're kidding?
No, inadvertently, we did a show, late night show in Edinburgh. And he has a very thick Scottish accent in real life. So I had a saxophone, and when he asked if I knew this song, I went, "Of course I do, mate." And then he went out, and I went, "I've just argued about..." We had an argument about which key it was in. it's a fun story. But he had his partner at the time was Peruvian, and she did this nose-whistling thing that she did the flute part. So instead of a flute, they had her. It was quite remarkable.
What a night.
It was a good story.
What a night. Speaking of Peruvian singing too, we had this...
I knew there'd be a link somewhere.
Yeah, we had the singer lined up toward the end of the show. I want to hear the singer that people have been emailing me about. Anyway, I welcome the Trans-Tasman bubble. I have much greater fear of the long-term impact of not opening to other nations, because Aussies only get us a fraction of missing tourism and trade. COVID's no longer the bogeyman it was, this person's view here. Treatment is much better. Survivability has increased massively, and vaccine is giving us back control. We need to get used to the idea that occasional cases will soon no longer be a threat to public health. Bit of fan mail for you, Anna. Gabrielle says, pass on to Anna Firefield that she's doing an excellent job with the Don Post Wellington. Her work on promoting what's on in Wellington, the arts and theatre reviews and the new columns featuring what Wellingtonians like about the city are a welcome change for the paper. Keep the good work. So that's nice, isn't it, Anna?
Oh, that's lovely. Thank you, Gabrielle, for that. I swear that's not my mum texting in. I did
right.
Not set that up.
Just on a side, and as a bit of an arts fan myself, was it your idea to really beef up the, I guess, the contemporary arts review stuff in the Don Post?
Yes, absolutely.
And
it was.
Why?
Yeah, no,
yeah.
I was a student here in Wellington in the 90s when Tom Cardy was writing in the Evening Post, and, you know, this is always what has given Wellington its texture and vibrancy. So, I could really notice the arts coverage missing from the Dominion Post on a daily basis. So that was one of the first things I did. And we've got Mark Amory came in as a contributing writer for us. He's also here on RNZ, and so he's really helped to revive that. But I hope that it helps to, you know, bring more dimension to the paper, but also celebrate the good things, right? We need that after the year we've all been through.
Well, it's kind of noticed too, and is it also because, you know, the Washington Post and the New York Times, when you read their arts section, the very, very grunty critical arts pieces, is that something you wanted to try and bring into New Zealand?
I mean, at the moment, I'm just trying for arts coverage at all. I mean, I would love, of course, to turn us into the New York Times or the Washington Post when it came to arts. But, I mean, yeah, hopefully this will gain some traction and we'll be able to extend it,
24-5, the panel, RNZ National. BNZ's latest digital skills report estimated 700,000 adults, or 20%, do not have the digital skills deemed essential for modern life. 21% didn't know how to upload documents and photographs when needed to complete an online transaction. 11% did not know how to pay for goods or services online. Now, the report also found close to 40% of people, or 1.3 million, do not know where to get help to stay safe and secure online. And this digital divide could lead to entrenched inequity over time. With us is BNZ Chief Economist Paul Conway. Kia ora, Paul.
Kia ora, tanakwe.
A couple of key findings there. This one really interested me. 21% didn't know how to upload documents or photographs when needed to complete an online transaction, which was very significant considering how often you're required to do this, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you have to upload all sorts of things for all sorts of purposes.
Yeah.
That's the kind of you know, that's the whole reason for this research, is that so much of the world has moved online. We really wanted to just have a look and say, well, you know, does that suit everyone? Does everyone have the capability to cope with that online world? And we found, you know, a lot to celebrate for us here in Aotearoa, New Zealand. There is a good, strong base of people that do have essential digital skills, about 80% of us. Also, about 95% of us use the internet at least a few times a week and have access at home. So, you know, we've invented this amazing piece of technology to keep us in touch with each other and do transactions. But, you know, and that's great, that's exciting. But the fact is, it doesn't work for all New Zealanders or, you know, all people globally. So we need to fix that.
Who are the least digitally engaged, Paul?
Well, if you look across, I guess the sort of, I think it's a bit of a cliche to some extent that older New Zealanders aren't that engaged digitally. It's true that older New Zealanders do lack digital skills compared to the rest of us. But, you know, I know plenty of older New Zealanders that are quite happy to get on their iPads and learn. And, you know, they love it when the sort of grandchild's smiling face turns up. Also, people on low incomes don't typically have great digital skills, or a bigger chunk of them don't have digital skills compared to average. And that sort of hints to the inequality aspect of this work, because, you know, working online is becoming so important for us, or even getting a job online. Recruitment has shifted to the online world. So we really want to avoid that sort of poverty trap where people on low incomes are just trapped there because they don't have the capability to sort of engage with the world, you know, the digital world. And the other one was people with disabilities. I think about 40% of people with a disability of some kind we found to be lacking in essential digital skills.
What do you make of this, Jeremy? I mean, the thing is here, every company pushes you to do things online, right? In part, it seems, by making contacting the company by phone so difficult.
Yeah, that was going to be my question, is how much of the onus here is on businesses, not only the making it harder to contact someone in person, but also it sort of seems that any time a new platform or a new upload service or something comes in, businesses sort of grab it and then don't necessarily instruct their customers on how to use it.
Sure. Mm. Oh, look, I think there's a huge onus on, you know, corporate New Zealand and businesses to really step up. And, you know, I should say there's plenty of action going on in this space, but to my mind, it clearly needs, you know, we need more of it in terms of getting more and more people online. And, you know, as you say, Jeremy, it's not just a challenge for the government. I think we've sort of relied on the government to sort of come up with solutions. But because it's, you know, so much of the world is moving online, that the onus is also on those corporates, those businesses that are asking people to engage with them online. We need to be part of the solution to ensure that they've got the skills to do that.
Anna Byfield?
Yeah, I mean, I think we really saw this digital divide during lockdown last year, right? When a lot of kids from lower decile schools or less, you know, more disadvantaged areas had no access to devices or not enough devices, no Wi-Fi, and you can really see how that will exacerbate already, you know, structural problems there. So,
I know. Well, that, That idea of social mobility, to get those kids out of that situation, you know, we need concentrated effort. And can I just call out the amazing work that Manaya Kalani does in that space? That's exactly their kaupapa. And again, you know, if we want outcomes for kids to be better than outcomes for their parents, if we want sort of social mobility in our society, then we've really got to get stuck in and remove that digital divide, get those kids onto the right side of the digital divide.
I'm just thinking too, but another aspect, Paul, that must be made mention of. This, surely this is all the more reason why you guys need to keep checks around for a lot longer. I mean, you're phasing them out, the main banks are, and I know that there are real concerns about this, not particularly particularly those with people who are known as neurodiverse. Many struggle with online systems like internet banking, and they are really concerned, that sector, that you are phasing out checks too soon.
Yeah. Wallace, I think this is a really important conversation. And again, it sort of gets to the whole kaupapa of this report, making sure, you know, it's not just about digital skills like apps. They need to be accessible. So I would, you know, I would say that there is a digital solution to get neurodiverse people using the web more.
What is that?
Well, accessibility, I think, is a big part of it. Or if people have, you know, problems sort of transposing a long bank account number, you know, use an email or a phone number. You know, like the fintech sector is coming up with solutions to these issues every day. So I fully acknowledge that there's an issue there, but I don't necessarily see that the solution is turning back the clock to an old, expensive legacy technology, which is checks. You know, we can make the digital world work for a much broader spectrum of our society. I mean, I should say, you know, 87%, I think, from memory, of people in our survey said that online banking helps them keep on top of their finances, and they think that the benefits are well worth the risk. So it's working for a lot of people, but we, again, you know, we need to make sure that it's working for everyone and that there isn't a group that's left out.
Just finally, has what effect has the pandemic had? Has the pandemic accelerated the e-economy? Is that Absolutely. What you've also seen?
Yeah, like the pandemic has brought forward the digital transformation. You know, people are saying 5 or 10 years. You know, and on the one hand, that's great because it's really freed us up. You know, we can work much more flexibly. I think it has improved well-being using the internet more. But unfortunately, it's also really exacerbated the impacts of the digital divide. So the people that are wearing the financial pain from the pandemic and associated lockdowns, they tend to be lower income New Zealanders because they're the people who can't work from home as easily as the rest of us. So it's been a real microcosm of the digital transformation. And I think, you know, we've learnt a lot about the benefits of online technology, but also the risks and also the issues that we really need to work on going forward to make sure this thing lives up to its potential.
Right. With us is, that was Paul Conway, BNZ Chief Economist, thank you very much for that. In terms of the economy, I mean, that's really, well, needless to say, it's really impacted media, hasn't it, Anna?
Yes, it absolutely has. I mean, first of all, you know, the internet bubble, like internet boom, I guess, you know, had a big impact on our business model. But now the rise of Google and Facebook stealing all of our digital advertising as well, it's become a big, big challenge for us. But, you know, this is a bit tangential, but something I was thinking about today as I was walking along and, you know, somebody sitting on the street asked me for money. And, of course, I don't carry any cash ever anymore.
Never.
So I apologise. I don't have any cash, but you know, in China now, because everything is done on your phone, you just scan QR codes to pay for things. So beggars and people on the street would have their own QR code, so you could give them a dollar or two just by scanning their code and transferring it on the spot there. And I was thinking to myself, I wonder how some of these people who are, you know, living rough on the street and seeking help are faring in this new environment. I don't
Goodness.
Have the answer.
You'd have people on the streets with their own QR code.
Yep, absolutely. You could be in the middle of nowhere in a little town and a guy would pull up on his rickety bike selling mandarins and you would scan his QR code to pay him.
Yeah, I must admit, I've never Amazing. Seen it that far. I was at a buskers festival. I remember the first time I saw that the buskers had their own FPOS machines.
Wow.
yeah, or, you know, scan and go Visa machines or whatever. So, but the QR code, that's a new one on me.
14 to 5, you're on the panel, NZ National. Fellow panellist Penny Ashton is an artist who has visited Wellington. Anna's direction in arts made a big difference to my season at Circa. Well, that's nice to hear. Thank you for that. All right. We had a bit of response regarding Caitlin Cherry's story of the day, which looked at the highest, a woman in British Columbia who had just broken the Guinness World Record for singing the lowest note by a female, known as C1, Joy Chapin, and Adam Lopez, who had the highest vocal note by a male, which is F sharp in the eighth octave. I'm not going to play it again, but it's extraordinarily high. Dogs loved it, apparently. Anyway, a lot of people got in touch with me about this Peruvian singer called Emma Sumac, who has, a record-breaking four-octave vocal range. She was a subject of a story in NPR not that long ago. Here's a little bit of her singing.
Bob
a very unique voice, isn't it? Peruvian singer Yma Sumac, Y-M-A-S-U-M-A-C, if you want to check that out.
I like her band. I think her lyricist could use a bit more work.
Yeah. Good Mambo styles, isn't it?
Very much so.
12 to 5, the panel. We had a really great response to a story we did last week on the Flax Museum in Foxton. And a lot of feedback came in about the museums that you like. Now, a couple of texts came in raving about this National Clock Museum. And yes, we have one, Clapham's National Clock Museum in Whangarei. Is home to a large array of clocks and timepieces, by all accounts one of the largest collections of clocks in the Southern Hemisphere. With us is Denise Scott. Welcome.
Hello, how are you?
Good. How did it all start?
Oh, it started with Archibald Clapham, who came over from Yorkshire as a very young man and eventually settled in Whangarei, and he loved clocks, and he collected and collected over his lifetime, and he ended up with over 400 in his little house. And he's wondering what to do with them. And he had four sons, and they said, well, we don't want 100 clocks each, Dad. You know, it was your passion, not ours. And so he decided that he would very generously donate them to the city.
How many do you have now?
Over 1,400, mostly by donations. That people have been very generous over the years.
And every day you have a feature clock. Today's, I see, is a Blaise Bontem Singing Birds Automation Clock, which is a fine example of French craftsmanship. And you've got a tree and nine birds. Do all the birds move?
They do. Most of them still move. It's a little bit old and faded now, but it's a really stunning piece that would have been magical in its day when people would have seen it.
Yeah. Denise, a couple of favourites for you?
Oh, the cuckoos are always a favourite. We've got a whole wall of those. People really love those. We've also got a really lovely little Atmos clock, which is self-winding, very clever little clock. It's an Art Deco from 1935. That's a particular favourite.
And do people enjoy the experience? I mean, it's quite a unique thing to have. I don't think I've ever been to a clock museum. Do people enjoy it?
They do, because it's fun, it's educational, it's a really interesting subject when you think of time and how you sort of regulate your day using it. There's novelty clocks for the children, they can do the clock hunt. So, you know, it's fun and educational.
Lovely. Denise Scott from Clapham's National Clock Museum in Whangarei, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, big response regarding those just wonderful little museums around the country, Jeremy Elwood. That
I
you
love
kind
them.
Of
yeah.
Aren't they great? That you there was I think there was a sock museum in Hokitika. One I mentioned was the Cody Museum. Any just off the top of mind?
Just off the top of mind. I mean, I'm lucky enough when I tour around the country, I quite often have time in a town. Not a specific museum of something, but there's a wonderful little museum in the Chatham Islands. You know, that you just walk into and there's nobody there. Yeah, you just put a couple of dollars in, you know, they need their own QR code for you to actually pay to get in there, probably. Good luck getting that one out to the Chathams.
You been there?
Yeah, I went out there. I spent a couple of days out there to do shows, weirdly enough. One of the more remote places I've been. But no, I love those little museums, and not just here, but around the world. They're fantastic.
Anna?
Japan has a lot of very weird and wonderful museums. Yeah, including my favourite in Tokyo, which is the Parasite Museum, where you can go in and see jars full of all sorts of long worms that have been pulled out of people's digestive tracts.
What?
I hope nobody's eating. Yes, Parasite Museum.
And that's your favourite?
No, my favourite for its quirkiness value.
Yeah.
Yes. Who would have thought?
Jeremy, I was going to say, it's a museum, isn't it? Not so quirky, perhaps. It's quite fairly medium-sized, isn't it? But when I first went to Ulverston in Dunedin, extraordinary how it was packed with items of the time.
Just overwhelming, really.
Amazing
it's,
house.
Yeah.
It's my picture.
Yeah, I know. I'm trying to remember if my mother worked there. She'll immediately text me and tell me, but I certainly knew people who worked there. And careful when you turn around so you don't knock over something that's incredibly valuable.
9 to 5, the panel, RNZ. Jill says, yes, we loved the Clapham Clock Museum when we visited from Christchurch. Vicky says, the demise of banks in small towns will accelerate the use of internet banking, as it will be really hard for shops to maintain afloat. Do spare a thought for charity collectors, op shops, teenage babysitters, rural fruit stalls, and the children trying to earn a dollar. It costs my charity $150 to hire an FPOS machine for a day for a plant sale. Well, that's not sustainable, is it?
Actually, that's a point I really should have brought up earlier, but it's only just come to my mind. I mean, one of the things that I think we're really going to have to look at around internet banking is the charges that are involved. I mean, the fact that I have to pay a convenience fee to pay my cell phone bill because I use a credit card, and there's virtually no other way for me to pay that bill. You know, those credit card, and I realise the onus of that is not on individual businesses often, it's on the major companies, but that's something that I think is going to be a growing issue going forward. Yeah.
Trish says, oh, remember Ivan Rebrov, an amazing Russian with an 8-octave range. Can you play some? No, we're not going to play any more people with high-octave ranges. There's no more. We've had done enough.
And I have just missed a call from my mother. She'll be telling me something about Alveston. Yeah. I keep my phone off in the studio, Mum.
7 to 5. Now to our weekly Monday afternoon business segment. Sarah Coldcourt founded New Zealand's largest Facebook group, Choice, formerly NZ Made Products, and co-founded its e-commerce partner, choice.co.nz. Two O's, by the way. Sarah, 23, started from her bedroom in Manurewa, Auckland, last year to promote her event management business, which was struggling due to COVID-19 lockdown restrictions. And her website has just turned one. Sarah was a nominee for the Young New Zealander of the Year and has become an advocate for small business owners and Pacifica entrepreneurs. Sarah is with us now. Kia ora, Sarah.
Kia ora, thank you for having me.
Pleasure to have you on. So happy birthday to Choice.
Thank you so much.
How many members when you're on?
Oh, we're on 550,000 members, 500,000 of which are based in New Zealand, and the other 50,000 are abroad.
It's quite extraordinary, wow. Really, because there are quite a few New Zealand-made product pages, but most of them only manage to gather a few thousand followers at the most and a few hundred, many of them. What made yours just go off into the ether?
Well, we've been around since, I think we're probably one of the first Facebook groups. And honestly, I couldn't tell you if there was a formula to it because I'm still trying to guess it myself, why we blew up the way we did. But I guess it's just the timing of everything. You know, everyone was in lockdown at the same time. I launched NZ Made Products, now Choice, second week of lockdown. Everyone's on social media trying to find ways to connect with one another. And actually, the influx of businesses to the Facebook group is actually because there was such a high need of other small businesses such as myself in the same predicament, looking for a platform to come promote their business.
Sarah, your background before this was in event management. What kind of events did you manage?
Everything from young leadership conferences in Wellington to summits for just leadership summits of some sort for a lot of organisations and trusts in South Auckland in particular.
But your background wasn't necessarily in sales, you know, in promoting a specific product.
No, I don't have background in marketing or sales or anything of the like.
That's great. Amazing.
Sarah, do you think you benefited from New Zealand's kind of increased reputation in the world with its response to COVID? Do you think suddenly New Zealand became very attractive and everybody wanted a piece of it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think with the extra eyes on New Zealand as a nation itself because of our response to COVID, that might have played a part in it. And actually, the Facebook group, because of the success of it, you know, again, what was used to be New Zealand Made Products, we've had a number of people reach out and say, we saw this Facebook group and we decided to start one in Ireland. And now we've got a website version because of following your one.
Wow, great.
You had a pretty hard time in lockdown, Sarah. You lost quite a bit of work.
Yes, I lost 100% of the work, all contracts overnight with the announcement from Jacinda that would be heading into level 4. And pretty much a few hours later, I received all of the phone calls from the various providers saying, we're going to have to cancel this one.
That sounds very familiar. My line of work, yep. I was at the other end of those phone calls going, no, we don't need the entertainment tonight. Mm.
So I understand, Sarah, because what it's done, it's become a bit of a lightning rod for people in your position first and foremost who actually did find it hard to get a footing. Now they've got a bit of a voice online, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. We're finding that a lot of people are including us in their marketing plans, which is awesome, and they're using Choice as the first point of call to promote or launch their new business or to debut or premiere or launch new products or services, which is actually really exciting. So we're not just a platform for people to come and promote and sell their products and services, but actually we're getting a pretty good reputation out there to be, you know, as the place to be.
Sarah, what's with the two O's? The pedant in me asks.
I can explain that one, actually. If you ask us on a usual occasion, we'll say you know, two O's, extra awesome. otherwise, in reality, someone took the domain name for normally.
Yeah. And Anna, isn't it wonderful to see a grassroots business really flourish like this, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, and Sarah, you're encapsulating lots of the things we've talked about in this program in terms of the reset that COVID has forced upon us and forced us to do things differently, but also the importance of those digital skills and being nimble and being able to adjust, I guess, in the internet age to a new way of doing things. So congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Hey, just before you go, we've only got about 30 seconds left because you have become a bit of an advocate for small business. Is there one big tip for a small business owner out there?
Yes, absolutely. Make sure you know, I guess, the legalities around your business when launching things. Otherwise, make sure you check out other platforms such as Menaki for advice when launching your business. Or even
Menaki, that's a good site. Thank you very much. And Anna, Jeremy, thank you very much.
Thank you.